At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Are you ready to reclaim your freedom and thrive? Introducing Living in Freedom, a three-part webinar series designed specifically for those who have broken free from systems of control. This comprehensive guide walks you through every stage of your journey to independence. Part one delves into the after effects and helps you anticipate what to expect after gaining or regaining your freedom. Part two provides guidance on healing, surviving, and thriving in your newfound freedom. And part three offers advice on sharing your experiences with others, explaining your journey, finding the support you need to continue your path to a life of independence. Whether you're just starting your journey to freedom or looking to strengthen your independence, this series provides the roadmap you need to move forward with confidence. This lecture and many more are available for purchase on my website, rachelbernsteintherapy.com. Just follow the link in the description of this episode to view and purchase all of the available lecture videos. Take good care. Hi, everyone. Today on the show, I am delighted to have a husband and wife team, Mike and Abby Prusak. Abby and Mike left the 2x2 church shortly after getting married following a faith crisis that led them to step away from Christianity altogether. Their departure strained family relationships and led to the loss of most of their social circle. One of the few enduring connections was with their friends, Kyle and Carrie Hanks. After Kyle and Carrie also left the church during the COVID-19 pandemic, the two couples launched a Facebook support group for former members in early 2022. In March of 2023, they publicly released a leaked letter exposing abuse by a former overseer. This opened the floodgates, and thousands of survivors began to come forward with their stories. This group rapidly grew from 900 participants to over 5,600 members, and they have since documented more than 600 individual abusers within the church, part of a total exceeding 1,000 in a religious community estimated at 75,000 members. That's a huge percentage. The FBI launched an investigation in 2024, which remains ongoing. In 2025, Mike and Abby released a leaked set of overseer meeting notes, which revealed troubling attitudes among church leadership, further validating the concerns of those who left. It is an important conversation that you're going to hear today. And it's so good to have Mike and Abby on the show. Here they are now. I want to welcome Abby and Mike Prusak to the show today. It is so wonderful to have you on and to have you here talking about a subject that I remember hearing about early on when I first started doing this work in the late 80s.
Wow.
And so when you first start doing something, there are some names of groups that imprint on you. because you're thinking, what is that? And you're looking it up and you're sort of fresh and green and you're wondering if it's going to come up again. So that was always what I wanted to do. I wanted to do some research just in case I got another call. And not a lot of calls came in about this group. Then suddenly, recently, there's a lot going on and it exploded again. And so I am so glad to have you here to talk about almost all what we have time to talk about today, almost all that's been happening, but you have such great insight. It's so nice to have you on. So if you don't mind just taking a moment and introducing yourselves, and then we'll start talking. Go for it.
I'm Abby.
And I'm Mike. And we were both raised in the 2x2 church. I was fourth and fifth generation, depending on which side of the family you look at.
I was second generation. My parents converted into the church.
Okay. That's great. When did you leave?
We left shortly after we were married, actually, about 15 years ago.
2010.
Okay. My goodness. So this is a group that has found its way or stayed in the shadows, I should say, for a really long time. And now not so much, which is a good thing. I mean, it's a good thing when things that I think should have been made public or exposed years ago are now finally able to see the light of day. But it takes a lot of courage and it takes a lot of time and a lot of powers that be, like the legal system or media and other people, to really be involved in the effort to make this kind of a difference. So I wonder, I'd love to hear more about your experience, knowing also that when you're born and raised in a group, it's a different experience than if you chose it later on in some significant ways, because it was all you knew. In this field, as some people know who have heard this, there's the term SGA, the second generation members. Not sure what A stands for, but still second generation. But it sounds also like it was fourth and fifth generation. So that is being deeply embedded into the psyche of your family. But for both of you to be born and raised into something that then you left, I'm so glad you had each other during that process. I'm sure it was fundamental to have that. And so let's talk just briefly about why you're coming on now, what's happening, and then we'll go back and listen to your stories to a great degree, and then come back to what's propelling you to want to get the word out now, and maybe what people can do as they're listening to support this effort in some way, even emotionally speaking. So tell us why you're coming on now, what's happening, and then we'll hear about your experiences.
Yeah, so first off, you mentioned earlier that it takes a lot of courage for this kind of thing to light. And I want to point out that there were a lot of people for many decades who had a lot of courage, more courage than we did in many cases. And there just wasn't this perfect storm that helped turn their courage into true publicity. And that's really a bummer. I don't know, you know, how else to put it. It's really unfortunate that these people, they put in a lot of effort. We are certainly not the first people to speak out. We just happened to be in the right place at the right time to amplify an issue that was already a huge issue for many, many decades.
The reason that we're here today is just to get the word out about the 2x2s and help people to understand there's a lot of people just out that have left the church maybe decades ago. They don't know the huge scandal that's happening right now, because once you leave, you are dead to the rest of the group. And so we still get people joining our support group all the time saying, I just found out about this. And you're like, oh man, we have so much to catch you up on.
We kind of have to warn them that joining the group, if you haven't had any background in this last couple of years, is kind of overload. Take it slow. And these people who don't have any idea about any of this may have been affected by the issues that are being brought to light decades ago, and they don't know that they can speak up now. They don't know the safe environment that we have, as safe as it can be, to bring forward the problems that they may have had. They may have left because they experienced abuse or something else, and they just may not know that there's support for them now. That's a real good advantage of everything being very public.
Really, really big advantage. And I think it's very kind of you to help people not be overwhelmed and to say like, yeah, sit down, fasten your seatbelt. Let's start driving slowly. Because that is important to do. It's reminding me of also starting this work when I started it over 30 years ago. And so I don't have to do now what I used to have to do for, I'd say, a majority of the past that I did this, which was just to prove to people that cults existed. And then also prove to people that there isn't something inherently wrong with people who get involved in them. Those were these two issues, these hurdles that I had to keep finding my way over just to get to talking about groups or talking about cults, where you had people in the audience saying, what is a cult, really? It's just a different kind of group. No, that's actually not really what it is. There must be something wrong with people who get involved, or they're gullible, or they're something. And there was just this focus on the people who were victimized by them, but not on the group itself. And so, yeah, I can only imagine what it's been like for people for decades shouting from the rooftops, the 2x2s are doing this, and this is what's happening there. And to have people say, what? This is a thing? You just wonder, where has this information been dying? How come it's not getting out and it's not getting absorbed? So you're right, I think, Abby, to talk about this as a perfect storm. And you want to ride it. It's really important to, and I'm glad that both of you are. So tell me about your experiences. And I'm wondering for you, Abby, also, if you can explain what 2x2 means, just by way of the heading of the group, and then talk about your own family experience and growing up as a woman in this church.
So the 2x2 is coined by outsiders. So within the church itself, they do not claim a name, but you need something to refer to your group as, especially if it's going to be exclusivist. So they will most often use the truth or the way, the fellowship, maybe the friends and workers. They call the members friends, and then the preachers are workers. So there's other ways they'll say, are they professing? Because when you join, you profess and you are a professing person. Oh, is that another professing person over there? So there are definitely names that they use, but they don't claim any name. And so the use of 2x2 refers to the ministry, which is an absolutely integral part of the church itself. And the ministers, they're homeless and celibate, and they are sent into a different field each year. And they have a companion when they're sent out. So they go out 2x2. They have a companion of the same sex. Males go out 2x2, females go out 2x2. So that's where that name came from, because you can't search the truth or the way or friends and workers and get anything. We were talking about how exes who have left a long time ago don't see this information. The other people who don't see the information is people inside the church. So we have teenagers who are like, I don't like this, but I don't know how to Google it. And so if you get the word out that there is a name that you can Google, 2x2, everything opens up and they can realize a bigger picture than just their town that's going on.
Right. It's a really important point. Mike, you were going to say something.
Yeah. Growing up, the term 2x2, we were not aware of it. And we had no idea that there was a whole community outside that was referring to it as the 2x2s. I think I had heard maybe like one person mention the term when I was growing up, but I had no context for that whatsoever.
And they'll often deny that it is the same thing. There was a worker that used to say, oh, they say we're a 2x2s, but we're not a piece of wood. Or there's even people to this day that'll be like, I don't know what you're talking about. We are not 2x2s, because they don't claim the name.
Right. And ultimately, it doesn't really matter, because the group is what it is and they are who they are. But you're right. It gives people a chance to look it up, to do research, to find out if there are court cases too, and sort of how you access all of that information online.
Yeah, we've posted some names, which we'll get into, but some names of abusers, and had people who didn't know any of this was happening. They just must have happened to Google the name of someone who abused them or their child. And they saw our content and they reached out and they were like, oh my gosh, what's going on? Even people who are not in the church, have never been in the church, who were abused by someone in the church. We've had those people reach out as well.
Wow. Okay. And the numbers, yes, I want you to talk about your stories. But when we come back to talking generally about what's happening now, I'd love for you both to give a sense of the numbers. I mean, they're staggering. the abusers and what's happened. And I don't know how different this is from other cultic groups, but I really like that the numbers have been counted, because when you're just dealing with a group and you're saying, yeah, they're pretty big and there was a lot of abuse, it's this amorphous generality that it really doesn't give people a chance to have a real flavor for the size of it. So I think it's great that it's been counted to whatever degree you can do that totally accurately, but it's sometimes an estimate, but still. So we will definitely address that a little bit later on. Abby, so tell us about growing up in this group and also as a woman in the group.
Like I said, my parents converted into it, and I think there's kind of a mixed bag as far as people who convert in, what route they take. And in my case, my parents went a very strict route, following all the rules very strictly. And because there's certainly like a measure of royalty status that families who have been in for several generations have, and we did not have that. There's a little measure of proving oneself. So yeah, I was raised more strictly than Mike was, I would say. Although we both were probably on the strict end of the spectrum as far as the rules and expectations go. And certainly raised with, it's really hard to explain because it's a very distinct form of femininity. It's a very matronly way of expressing femininity. There's a lot of expectation on modesty. We were supposed to wear skirts or dresses at all times, never cut your hair, usually wear it up on top of your head, except kids often will wear it in ponytails or braids. And no jewelry, no makeup, those kinds of things. Very much guided you into a matronly version of being a woman. I would say that I had a little bit of an extra layer of complexity in that I am not a very feminine person. And I didn't know that because I never got to actually try to be a feminine person. So the matronly version certainly wasn't my thing, but I didn't have an option. So that's just where I was. And then as I got a little bit older and experimented with more, I don't know, less matronly versions of femininity in college and such, trying to be an attractive person, tried that for a while and realized over time that that wasn't me either. So it took me a long time to kind of find me down there somewhere after being raised like that with only one option. I do call it an exoskeleton. We are all handed an exoskeleton as children, and that's who we are. We fit into that. And when you leave, you have to peel that off and figure out who's underneath, because you don't know yet. You just know that it doesn't fit. You're too big for it and you have to shed it. And with things that do shed their exoskeleton, tarantulas, I often use this, when they do shed their exoskeleton, they are very, very vulnerable during the process and for a while after. It's a big deal. And that has really resonated with me, that idea. The 2x2s love to, somebody just mentioned this to you on your podcast, spiritualize the cat. Spiritualize absolutely anything that is not spiritual. And so this tarantula metaphor really worked for me because I'm used to that. But
you're spiritualizing the tarantula.
Spiritualizing the tarantula. It really helped me to understand what the process was that I was going through and what I went through and why it wasn't easy and why I didn't automatically know what was under that when I left.
That's very interesting. It is a very vulnerable time when you shed your skin, when you don't have the protection, and it can make you behave differently during that time, be more fearful or be more attacking. It's like a wounded animal might try to bite you when you try to help it just because it's feeling vulnerable. I mean, it shifts people's behaviors at time.
During that time, the other reaction can also be, when you feel unsafe and vulnerable, to cling to something else that feels safe, generally a different version of what you just came from. We have seen people jump into something that's just similar enough to feel safe, but different enough to not be the same named group. But it's hard to really pull the whole exoskeleton off and figure out where to go from the beginning.
Very much so. And I'm wondering also, going back to this idea of feeling safe, as we're going to move forward talking about so much that happened that was abusive, I know that there can also be a lot that feels neglectful in groups like this. So I'm wondering about your overall feelings of safety, and if there are things that occurred or you found out occurred, or things happened to people, or that people weren't protected. Sometimes you just hear about those things, which can make you feel vulnerable yourself, whether things happen directly to you or not. So I'm wondering about your recollections on just feeling safe.
For myself, I generally felt, and this is coming from the perspective of a male in the group, which is very, very different from the perspective of a female in the 2x2s. I generally felt fairly safe, but only because I was the most rule-following kid of all time. So I was not testing any boundaries. I wasn't trying to participate in the ways of the world in any way. And on the few occasions that I did dip my toe into those worldly things, which in this case is like going to a movie theater or something like that, I figured out pretty quickly that that was not going to be okay with the people that were around me. So at least for me, I felt safe, but it wasn't a very realistic version of safe. It was a facade, really.
I was kind of going to say a similar thing. Like, I felt safe. I had no inkling at any point in my, well, I mean, there's nuance here, but in the 2x2 environment, in meetings, and the services are called meetings, in meetings, I felt safe. I had no idea that I should feel any different. And I think I generally was safe most of the time. But then I grew up and realized how unsafe I definitely was some of the time, how I spent time, quite a bit of time, and was even dropped off alone at the house of a known pedophile who my family and the people around me all knew was a pedophile. So there are times when I'd look back and I'm like, whoa, I was not safe there. But I always felt safe. I was completely sheltered from the idea that I could maybe not be.
We were told from the moment we were born that these people were the safest people in the entire world.
It was the rest of the world that was unsafe.
So you just kind of absorb that through osmosis through your entire childhood. And so to say anything otherwise would not only be, it would be uncomfortable for you, but it would be uncomfortable for everybody around you, because everybody around you is making the assumption that their group and everybody in it is safe.
It's hard because there is the church and its expectations and its culture. And then you have each family and their expectations and their culture, and often affected by the church. But some families are going to act a lot different than other families. So when you asked me if I felt safe, there were a lot of times emotionally I did not feel safe, sometimes physically, but not necessarily in meetings. I thought I was completely safe. There are a lot of sides of that. But yeah, there's definitely an illusion of safety.
Yeah, illusion of safety. And I think that's why it is also so shocking when something happens to you or when you hear about something happening to someone else, because it's reminding me of people also who feel that they have like a force field around them, that they can do anything and they're protected because they're in the group. And a lot of people have shared, like in this general, not for the 2x2s that you have a support group for, but just sort of the general former cult member support group that I run, people say, oh, I walk down a dark alley at night because I just knew, in quotes, but I knew that God was going to protect me. Nothing bad was going to happen to me. And now I look back and I think it was just luck that nothing happened. It wasn't necessarily God's protection, but that when something does happen, it is such a shock to the system. Also because you haven't been exposed to the world and exposed to the fact that there are these people out there who could be predators, et cetera. I mean, all of that is so incredibly foreign.
What's funny though, because I don't think that the 2x2s are quite the same as whatever group those people came from. We weren't taught that God was going to keep us safe. I never would have believed that God was going to keep me safe physically.
No. In fact, a lot of preaching goes along the lines of you're going to experience extreme hardship in order to make you stronger.
Yeah, and that the world was unsafe. In the world, going down a dark alley, there were probably predators around every corner. This idea, I've been documenting, scanning, and kind of archiving a lot of old sermons lately that people have sent to me. And it's just over and over and over again in those. The world is unsafe. It is dangerous. It is evil. There are people trying to take your peace from you. It's only safe here. And as you leave convention, you might get in a car wreck and die. So hope they were on the right side at that time. There was never security. I never felt security in that way, spiritually.
Wow, that is very interesting. Right, and that's going to go to what you were saying, Mike, about being a rule follower. I mean, I think it's going to really prompt people to feel like I have to do this right. I have to get this right, I think, in order to feel, I guess, safer in the church, but also maybe to have my world feel secure, that I'm doing things just as I should, which can sometimes relax the whole nervous system. And I'm wondering to ask you, for you, Mike, being fourth and fifth generation, tell me about your family and how they first got involved, because that was the early days. And then how it was for you growing up, which I know you've shared a little bit about, but take us back into history a bit.
At least on my mom's side, I don't know my dad's side as well, but they converted right around 1905, 1910-ish over in Alaska, because as soon as the workers came over from Ireland, they spread out across the United States pretty quickly and apparently made a beeline to Alaska of all places. And so that's where my family got pulled into it. And it wasn't talked about a ton, but there was definitely a feeling of feeling special, of being one of the first families in that region to join the church and to be, I assume my family was instrumental in spreading it to some degree in that area. So there was a little bit of a legacy, perhaps, tied to the family. Growing up in it, my dad was an elder from when I was pretty young. I think I was probably under 10 when he became an elder, and we began to have meeting in our house. And I didn't necessarily feel like I had a lot to like necessarily live up to, but I think there was a subconscious level of that where I was an elder's kid, and so I needed to uphold the standards just a little bit better than everybody else. Abby, you mentioned that it seemed like we were on the stricter side, both of our families. I suppose they were to a degree, but at the same time, I felt when I was growing up that we were a little bit on the less strict side because we were allowed to watch movies. Now, we weren't allowed to have a TV. We would watch them on a, quote, monitor, which was just like a little 15-inch thing that we would hook a VCR up to. The thing that's really funny is all of the rules, most of them have little loopholes. And the TV one is especially a very large loophole. And of course, with the internet now, everybody has TV on their phones, blah, blah, blah. But back in the 90s and even the 80s, there was the loophole of just watching it on a monitor, as long as it didn't have a TV antenna that was getting the waves out of the air.
Did the workers approve of that, though?
You still were storing this in a closet when the workers came over. So my family, you know, we fed on that loophole quite a bit. That's kind of how my childhood went, was we had these rules that were not followed when the church leadership wasn't around, but of course you put it away when the church leader. And so that creates a weird flipping in the brain constantly, trying to like figure out like, okay, right now, what kind of person am I going to be? Am I going to be the person that's around the workers, or am I going to be just the kid that's just living life?
And I would say your family did that less than a lot of families. There were a lot of families that the girls would wear pants to school unless the workers were going to be around. There were some families. I don't know if a lot really works there, but there were families that had actual TVs in their closets and then would have to lock the closet when their workers come so they don't find it or something.
Right, right. So it was just me and my brother. So we didn't have any women in, aside from my mom, and we didn't have like a sister that had to follow those rules. So we didn't really get a full picture of what it was like to be a female growing up in it. It was just us boys.
Just you boys, right. So a couple things about that. First, it does happen over time as generations go into other generations that you're going to have this idea of legacy, that you're going to be this special family, like some of the founding families in certain areas that help to really establish it in certain areas. But then sometimes there can be a bit of a watered down, I've seen a watered down version over many generations. Like, this is our life. And we might not be as gung-ho about it. We might not be as fearful about not following the rules, but this is our community. This is what we know. And so it becomes, the attachment is for other reasons. Then also, it is so human to find loopholes. It is our need to push the walls out, to see where we have freedom, to see where we can make our own choices. And you're right, it plays with your head because you're thinking, if this is a rule, there must be some spiritual or God-related reason for it, but nothing bad is happening to us when we're taking this monitor out of the closet. We're still good people. So then does that have a domino effect on wondering about the other rules? Maybe they're just rules for the sake of rules, and maybe I don't have to be worried about not following them. What does that do?
Yeah. Another fun one was the IMAX loophole. Like I said, we weren't allowed to go to theaters. And also ministers would go to IMAX as well.
The ones that we were familiar with in our area, yeah. Which we grew up in the Pacific Northwest.
Right. Of the. I'm sure that there was anti-IMAX workers in other parts of the country, but it was like, oh, you're going to watch a documentary on a really large screen. That's okay.
But if the documentary was in a theater, they wouldn't have gone.
Right. It's so mind-bending, the very specific rules that they had and how they chose to follow them.
Was there a difference in maybe what IMAX like served and what regular theaters served at first, I wonder?
Well, yeah, because IMAX, until what, the early 2000s, IMAX was purely documentaries. They weren't showing movies like they are now.
I had the impression for some reason that theaters served alcohol.
Oh.
I know they don't now. Did they ever? I don't know. I feel like that was one of the reasons why they were no-no zones, but I guess not.
Movies are like alcohol for your eyes.
Yes.
I'm sure there are some movie theaters that might have a bar. In fact, I actually do know one near me, but I think you can't bring it into the theater because, yeah, that would be a problem. But they'll find a way to make money. And so if people buy alcohol, great. But yeah, I do wonder about that, though, like, even just what you brought up, Abby, it's fascinating. That made me think that it must be because they serve alcohol there. Like, I'm sure there are a lot of suppositions about the world. Like, when you're kept from things, you can really start to wonder why. And your imagination fills in a lot of the blanks. And usually it fills it in with the information you've been told or the biases that you've been given about the world and how it's so lawless or out of control.
Yeah, in the sermons that we all grew up just from day one listening to, one thing about the workers, the 2x2 workers, is that they don't speak straightforward ever, almost ever. So everything is coded. It's usually in like parables or metaphors. They're usually spiritualizing a cat to tell you to wear dresses or something, but it's never said out loud. We call this the great gaslighting that's happening right now, where they're like, we never said that. Like, no, you absolutely taught that. Maybe you didn't say dresses, but you taught it. We actually just listened to a sermon on Sunday or something like that, where a worker was talking about how people weren't respectful enough and dressing well enough. And he said multiple times, I'm not going to go into details because that's between you and God. But like everybody in that tent knew what he was talking about. Everybody knew. He meant dresses, below the knee, modesty, no short hair, no jewelry, no makeup. Everybody knew that's what he meant.
And that's the hard part about this church in particular. There's a lot of other churches and maybe the things that are considered cults that at least have the rules written down. Aside from the notes from the sermons that are taken in a gospel meeting or in a convention meeting, apart from that, we have nothing written down. There's nothing written down about the doctrine of the church. It's all word of mouth. And again, like passed down through the notes that the members take. And
then sometimes letters.
Sometimes letters from the leadership as well. But
individually,
you had no idea what the actual doctrine of the church was. You just had to kind of infer it. And that's the benefit of growing up in it, is you were able to absorb that from the very beginning. Whereas there's some people that join later in life. Some of them have a really hard time figuring out what the actual rules are, and they just have to watch everybody else around them and start to emulate them as much as possible in order to fit in.
I had a friend when I was in elementary school who came to meeting with me one time, and my mom was telling me later that it was just so sweet how during prayer, she was looking around and she just reached up and took her earrings out because she noticed that nobody else was wearing them. And to my mom, it was really sweet, like she was getting the spirit of it or she was whatever. She just knew she didn't fit in. And then we heard another sermon just last week from a lady who, she was from the Philippines. These two white men, these workers, there's a lot of colonizer vibes. It went and gave them the truth. And she noticed, she looked around and she noticed, oh, these women's hair is long. Oh, they're wearing dresses. And she talked about this in such a wonderful spiritual way that she didn't have to be told what the rules were.
She was seeing it through the spirit. What they say is happening.
Right.
But you know, really, it's just conforming through social cues.
Yeah, it's social policing. It's these social boundaries. The other problem that I wanted to mention with that vague breaching, with the vague rules, you were talking about having kind of a different set of rules when you were around other professing people and when you weren't. Part of the doctrine of the 2x2 church is that you never know if you're saved. So whereas a lot of churches operate on a grace doctrine where Jesus died for you and now you're serving him out of love, the 2x2s operate on a works doctrine where it is not just works because you also have to be in the 2x2 church, but you never know on any given day whether you've done enough. And so breaking the rules outside can really cause a lot of heavy guilt and shame for a lot of people. And a lot of people develop OCD, scrupulosity, hypervigilance, and CPTSD from these types of conflicts in their head all growing up.
I'm sure. Going back to this idea of things not being written down and things being said in metaphor or parable, it does feel like if we look at it skeptically, it is so that there isn't accountability, so there can be gaslighting. I don't know if there's another reason for it to have it be so unclear. Is there another origin story on that?
I'm not sure that it was a conscious decision by anyone. I think that the language of those early evangelical groups was all kind of the same. It was all pretty vague. They were using things out of context biblically a lot of times just to make a really cool sounding story. That kind of just followed the group up to the present day.
One thing that the truth, I try not to use 2x2 all the time because the truth is like the name that they decided on and it sounds pretty high demand religion-y or culty. And I don't really want to give them the out for that by always saying the 2x2. So anyway, sometimes I will say the truth. One of the things that they consider so magical about their specific group is that the Spirit can speak to two different people in the same meeting through the sermon that's coming, and they can get different messages from it. There's only one way that happens is if you are vague enough to let people interpret it how they will. And I relate this to like tarot cards. If you're not like believing in the magic of tarot cards, if you're just using them as prompts, thought prompts, and you go, oh, what can I think about regarding this that like I need to process in my head? That's the same thing that's happening in those meetings. They also avoid accountability that way because one person can say, you were talking about this, I know it. And they're like, well, no, this somebody else can say, no, I thought he was talking about this. So it feeds into that huge guest culture. I don't know if you're familiar with guest culture versus ask culture, where everything you have to read between the lines and you talk between the lines, like it's very vague, so as to not ever be firm in your language or controversial, upset the peace, or say anything straight out that you can be held accountable for. So the other thing regarding accountability is that from the beginning, they have had a history of intentionally not recording things. There is no roster of membership. There is nothing like that. And then destroying what records they did need to write down. So each year there is a worker list for any given region. So let's say Washington, North Idaho, Alaska, there will be a worker list that comes out that will list each worker and their companion. So each pair of workers for the year, they switch constantly. They switch companions every year, usually. And then what field they're in. So it may be a few towns like Coeur d'Alene, Post Falls, Spokane Valley or something. And those lists, they didn't always have this, but people generally knew that they should. But sometimes they did actually write on them, destroy after use. So when it wasn't time for that year anymore, they would shred them or burn them.
And there was also just unspoken, like there's people that were shredding them every single year and they didn't even know why. It was just because their parents had done it as well.
Even Bible study lists.
Yeah.
Lists of what to study each week, even those, every single bit of documentation, the reasoning was that they didn't want it to get into the wrong hands. And they've never defined who that is. I think it's me now, but at the time, it wasn't me. But I think it was just fear of being known, which is why this last couple of years is so scary for them. But the destroying of those records also destroyed the opportunity for accountability for survivors, because there's no record of where those workers have been their whole lives. And also, another part of that secrecy is not registering their church with the government. We actually had an overseer last year, it might have been in 2023 or 2024, say that they don't adopt unified policies. They stay in their little regional silos. And he said, and it has protected us in the past. So they are protected from being held accountable as an organization if they just don't organize enough publicly. But we all know what the organization system is.
You know, the whole idea of things not getting into the wrong hands, it really does foster this whole us versus them, or actually them versus us kind of idea about the world, and that we have to be careful and we're going to be found out and the world is then going to want to destroy us. And then when things start to come to light, that notion can be used as though this is the world working against the church as opposed to the church doing something that they shouldn't. What also happens, and I don't know if this happened, but this is a common thing, that people start finding a way to hold on to documentation when they see that something is going wrong. And they might make another copy before they destroy what looks like the only copy of it. And when you start doing it, it's like if you feel like your business partner is taking from you or your spouse is cheating or whatever, people will notice that they start trying to collect data because they know that there's going to be gaslighting. They know that they might also succumb to being convinced that they misunderstood or that they misremembered. So they need something in black and white to hold on to the reality of the situation. And I wonder if that's part of what happened here. It would be very natural for it to.
There have been people over time who have not destroyed those things. There are certainly some people who held on to it, usually in kind of a reverent history type of way. Now, some of those people have left, or their kids have left, their grown children, and they have sent them to us, a lot of them. So we did a lot of work. We have done and still doing a lot of work on trying to document those things before they slip out of history forever. And this is worker lists and worker photos, sermons.
Convention lists. Basically, it's trying to get as much stuff that will tell where people were at any given time so that if something comes up and a survivor needs to prove that this person was in their area during that year, that they experienced something problematic.
A piece toward that.
Anyway. It's a piece toward it. Yeah. And maybe it's not necessarily something that's going to come up in a courtroom, but it can give that survivor a little bit of validation, knowing, okay, I didn't imagine this. This person was here. It's right here on this piece of paper.
We've even helped survivors remember who it was that hurt them, because they'll say, I know it was this year and I can kind of see his face. And we'll say, oh, well, these people were in your field that year and here's a picture of them. And oh, it was him. Because there's a lot of people that are recovering memories right now. Along with that feeling of being safe, I forgot, I was going to mention this earlier, that feeling of being safe and then growing up and realizing you weren't, you start to look back at your experiences and go, oh, that was a really unsafe, did I experience something that wasn't okay in that experience? Wait a minute, I brushed all this off as okay, as safe, and it turns out it wasn't. So now I need to kind of go reassess these things. And then some stuff can just come up just out of the blue. We've had a lot of people with a lot of hard therapy experiences with resurfacing memories.
It's very painful also. If there's so much self-talk, thought stopping, you learn. And to just hold on to the memory, but also give it credibility. This matters that this happened and I mattered and this shouldn't have happened to me. And there is a lot almost that you have to validate and confirm about you have enough value to have something bad that happened to you be wrong and to hold someone accountable. I want to talk more about some of the things that have been uncovered, but I want to hear about how the two of you left and what that process was like, because people listening to this podcast to a certain degree are people who are sometimes still involved in certain relationships or cultic groups and are often using the content of this show to get some clarity about how this is happening to them too. And so maybe this is why they're having nightmares and maybe this is why they're feeling so unhappy. Or people who have left who are looking for how people do that and what they need after they leave. So what prompted both of you to leave? And then we'll talk more about these stories.
I sometimes wish that my reason for leaving was, oh, I figured out how horrible the group was, and it was so bad that I just couldn't not leave.
We wish we'd left on like moral grounds.
Right, yes.
Right. And it sort of was moral grounds, I guess, in a different way.
In a matter of principle, we had to follow what we were believing.
But. Yeah. So we left really because we were having a faith crisis. We came to a realization. We were actually just sitting in bed one night, just shortly after we'd gotten married.
Had not talked about any of this before.
No.
Had not really even thought about it.
Never had talked about doubts with each other at all.
I hadn't even thought about it, honestly, I don't think.
Yeah. I mean, to talk about doubts was, I'm sure people did with their spouses all the time. I sure hope they did, but we didn't. We were just along for the ride. We just knew this is what we were born into. This is what life was. And we didn't really have any inkling of doing anything different. And we're sitting in bed one night and we don't even remember who said it, but one of us said, do you actually hear anything when you pray? And the other person was like, well, no, I guess not really. And it just cascaded from there. Like, as soon as we had somebody along with us that was willing to take that journey of opening the box and just seeing how far things went, we really deconstructed pretty quickly from Christianity at that point.
We tried really hard to hang on to it. We tested it. We tried our faith. We tested the spirits. Whatever you want to say, we prayed our little heads off. I know I did. I remember praying and just like begging and pleading and then just waiting. I prayed really hard. It's really hard when people who are inside a group like that, when you leave, there's no way that they can acknowledge that you did that. Must not have prayed hard enough, because praying hard and not getting an answer isn't an option. Or you weren't patient enough or whatever. And I'm like, I did everything I could until it felt dishonest to keep pretending that we believed that.
We spent 6 months just continuing to attend, acting like everything was normal, just doing our best to try to fit in and see if it would work. And after 6 months, we realized this is just going nowhere. We're just sitting here faking it every Sunday and every Wednesday. So we, at that point, sent a letter to our friends and family and our elders to let them know that it wasn't an exit. We were still going to attend, but we just weren't going to participate anymore because we didn't feel like it was honest to be saying these things every single week. And so
we began the most awkward 3 months of our lives.
So we would go. So the way meeting is set up is you go there, it's a small, maybe 20, 30 people
in a living room,
and you're supposed to pray and you sing hymns, and then you have your testimony time, which is when you stand up and you just speak a little bit about like what the Spirit has spoken to you.
What bread you brought that week.
Yeah, we weren't standing up, but our elder, you could tell he was really hoping we were just going to change our minds. So he would just leave a very pregnant pause at the very end of the testimony
like
time.
Like a minute. It was so bad.
This room full of people. Everybody knows why he's doing it. And we're just sitting there.
And the other admins of the support group, the ones we started the support group with, were in that meeting each week. And they remember how awkward it was. It was funny to talk to them after they left and see like what their impression was of that time.
Wow. Yeah. And that pregnant pause, that was just a minute. It probably felt like an hour.
Oh. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So bad.
Yeah. That's all.
And it felt very disrespectful, honestly.
Yeah. But that's kind of how it is. When somebody is doubting or wants to leave or has left, it immediately starts a story in all of the members' heads of, okay, well, they weren't willing enough. They didn't try hard enough. They weren't praying hard. Maybe they're struggling with some kind of other vice in their life that is bringing them away. All those stories, they start automatically happening in everybody's head to justify why they're okay. So after 2 or 3 months of that, we just stopped going. We weren't getting anything out of it. It was awkward. And we had better things to do on a Sunday morning, honestly.
And before we actually bounced entirely, we were going through a pretty big crisis as far as like, okay, we don't believe this anymore. We have tried to believe this. We don't believe it. But this community is the safest place you can be. It's the best place to raise. It's so wholesome. It's the best place to raise kids. We hadn't had any kids at that point, but they were going to be pretty shortly on the horizon. And we actually discussed staying in the church and faking it for the rest of our lives for our kids' sake so that they could grow up there.
That gives you an idea of just how brainwashed we were into thinking that this was the best place, even if we couldn't believe it ourselves.
It's not just spiritual attachment. It's everything else. It convinces you that every single part of your life is only good in this group. It's not just do your religious thing the best in this group. It's everything else as well.
Right. And I think also how you handled it was so thoughtful, and you really dug deep and you gave it a shot and you prayed and you were hoping to get a sign, a message. This was a really, I think, a really important and honest effort. It wasn't flippant at all. And I think that's often how it's portrayed, like someone just decided to leave. No, it usually is years in the making, actually, just things that start accumulating.
Yeah, it couldn't be flippant because we knew the consequences of leaving. You can flippantly leave a mainstream church pretty easily because nobody's going to come after you. Not that they came after us, but nobody's going to express extreme sorrow at you leaving.
There aren't necessarily massive social, familial, cultural damages that are incurred. And that's one of the reasons people are like, it's not a cult. You can leave anytime you want. Okay, but if you know that you're going to lose your family on some level, your friends, your community, if you know you're going to lose all of that when you leave, you're not free to leave anytime you want. And I'm really, really glad that we went through that process because I am completely at peace that we did everything we could. We were genuine in our trying. And while people inside the church can't accept that because it would break their shelf, so to speak, I know in my heart that we did everything we could and it's settled. I have no doubts. We did it the right way.
That's really important to be able to say and to know and to feel. So it's really good that you gave yourselves that. I think it's also interesting to hear how people define cult in a way that's going to fit the argument. Like, well, you can leave at any time, so it's not a cult. Really, that's like not even one of the things I would think of if someone said, what's a cult? Because it really is so much about other things and about deception and about people sometimes pretending to be someone who they're not. Sometimes things that are presented as safe turn out not to be. And you don't have a say, or you're going to lose your community if you speak up. I mean, it's all the mechanisms of control. But yeah, most people can leave physically.
There's a lot of bounded choice in cults. And I also really like the term high demand religion. There's an image there that is more vivid than just the hot word of cult.
Yeah, when cult can mean Jim Jones and also mean Jehovah's Witness, there's a big gap in between all those that really needs a little bit more definition, I think.
Yeah, I agree. So were you starting to hear about some of the things that were happening before you left, or was this only after?
So before we left, I don't know, Abby hadn't looked up much online about
anything.
The church. When I was a late teen, I had done some searching and I found the Truth Message Board, which was like a really early conversation board for people that both in and out. I had learned about the origins of the church through that. And also, there was some talk about sexual abuse of various kinds in there. But at the time, leaving wasn't at all on my mind at all. So it didn't have an influence on me of, oh, maybe I should be looking into this a little bit more. I just didn't have the thought of thinking about it more than, oh, yeah, that's happened and it's unfortunate.
You put it on your shelf.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've heard that idea. Yeah.
It was mostly after we left that we started to engage a little bit more in the X2YT community and began to learn a little bit more about the abuses that had been going on.
And I was upset at first when we left and he was looking a lot more into these message boards and stuff like that. It made me kind of mad inside. Like, I wasn't like mad at him. It brought up anger inside me and I did not want to look at any of it. And I think maybe part of it was because it would have been so overwhelming, but also it was so ingrained in me to have those feelings when thinking about the exes talking about the church.
Oh, it's very hard to look at. You wonder what you're going to see, what you're going to find, how it's going to make you feel. It's so much easier to avoid it all, actually. But you dove in, and thank goodness you did, actually. But I wonder about some of the things that you uncovered and that have been uncovered that would be important for people now to hear about.
Well, first, it's probably important to note that for 13 years, we were largely silent about it. In some of those later years, we joined a couple of existing Facebook groups that were sort of active, and most of them were very Christian-based, Some of them included inside and outside. We participated a bit in those, but publicly we were silent about this. We were trying to maintain family relationships. Both of us, our families are still in, and it was really, really difficult. And there is a culture where just being yourself outside of the church, or even like identifying that you used to be a part of it and you're not, it feels very much like a personal attack to those people that are still in. And so we did the quiet, just stay quiet about it, try to live our lives. It was Mike and I against the world for a good decade. Yeah, that was that phase. And then do you want to talk about, well, I'll start at 2022.
All hell broke loose.
Quite in 2022 yet, but.
Well, in 2022, 2020, 2021, so our friends, Kyle and Kari Hanks, we had remained friends with them through leaving. They were one of the few couples that actually kept a relationship with us over those years.
Unconditional type of relationship. They weren't just trying to be nice.
You know, we didn't talk about religious stuff. We didn't talk about church stuff with them. That was just kind of an unspoken thing that we just didn't talk about, and we got along fine. And then in around 2020, they started talking to us about some doubts about things that were going on in the church, and they were having their own deconstruction a little bit, their own faith crisis to a degree.
And the way that the church behaved during COVID was really hard for them, given that they have some health things that made it unsafe for them to meet. But the church was kind of in turmoil around all that stuff. And a lot of people were saying, God will keep you safe. If you have faith, you'll be there anyway. It shouldn't matter. So there were a lot of hard things anyway.
Kyle and Kari, by 2021, they had made the decision to leave completely. And they, I don't know which one of them it was. They'll tell their own story. But they wanted to give a little bit more support to the ex community because just wasn't a lot available at that moment. Kari and Kyle asked us if we wanted to start a Facebook support group for ex-members. And so we did. And that was in January of 2022.
It was a little bit scary. It was X282 support group and our profile pictures on there as admins that anybody could see. The group is private, but anybody can see who the admins are. And so there was a time where like, I wonder if our families have seen this yet.
Yeah, just starting the group as admins was a huge step in public pronouncement that we're doing this. So then in June of 2022, we learned that a worker named Dean Brewer, who was the overseer of Oregon. Very highly revered. Probably one of the top 10 overseers in the church at the time. He was found dead in a hotel room in Oregon. And at the time, we definitely thought it was weird because usually they don't stay in hotel rooms. They stay in the homes of the congregants.
And there was one like a couple miles down the road.
Yeah, and there was a family just not very far from where he was. I think the story was told that, well, maybe he had COVID and so he didn't want to infect anybody. And so he stayed at this hotel.
Nobody really knew.
Yeah. So that happens. They have a gigantic funeral for him. I mean, probably close to 1,000 people, at least over 500 people attended his funeral on the convention grounds in Oregon.
Recorded or live streamed?
Both. This was available. And then 9 months later, in March of 2023, the overseer that took over for Dean in Oregon, he created a letter that admitted that Dean had been abusing women and children through his life. But this letter was not being distributed widely. It was being given to certain workers, and they were to hand it to the elders, let them read it, and then have it handed back.
In a very localized area. But yeah. Dean had been around the entire world.
And so one of the elders' wives secretly, I think the workers knew that she took a picture, but she took a picture of this and then handed the letter back. Would have been frowned upon. And she then transcribed that picture into a typed document and sent it through her sister to Kari. And we put it up online in the private group. And also Abby and Kari shared it on their public Facebook pages.
We had 900 members in the Facebook group at that point, which I'll say when we first started it, we were kind of talking, hey, if we get like 50 people in here, that's going to be pretty fantastic. And so cut to a year later when we had 900 people the day that we released this letter.
Yeah. So this letter goes up, and looking back on that post, even there was people disclosing abuse in that original post already. That just gives you an idea of what kind of a tidal wave that letter sent off. People were just waiting for permission, waiting for an opportunity to share their story. And this was it.
These weren't allegations of abuse toward Dean Brewer. These were other people in the church, other workers, and sometimes members.
So initially, Abby kind of became the documentarian between us four admins. And
also, Kari and I were doing survivor contact at first. Mike and Kyle kind of took on some more of the administrative type of things, but we were all going like 14 hours a day at first. Kari and I were both trying to homeschool our kids too. We each have three kids, basically the same exact ages. You can imagine the homeschool wasn't going that well at the, but we were literally working probably 14 hours a day for a while. And Kari and I were doing survivor contact. So when somebody would disclose abuse in the group or when they would join the group and in their join questions, they would disclose abuse, we would reach out and just provide them with resources and things like that. Or people would just message us directly and just start telling us abuse stories. And Kari and I combined were probably talking to upwards of 20 survivors a day. It was a lot. And I realized very, very early on that we need to write this down. We need to figure out how to maintain some sort of record of what's happening. And so, yeah, we started a list of alleged perpetrators and just kind of tried to document everything. Started in a Word document, and then we eventually had to figure out how to make it better and how to get it into a spreadsheet and everything, because now we have over 600 perpetrators on that list. Yeah. And there's another list.
Yeah, the largest list that's in existence right now is over 1,100 perpetrators.
Oh my goodness. Okay, 1,100.
Yeah, and just to give that a little bit of context, the church size, at its peak back in the 80s, the church was probably around between 200 and 300,000 members, around 200,000 at its peak. But around 2020, the estimate was about 75,000. And now, I mean, at least 10 to 20,000 people have left now. So at the time that this all was happening, coming out, you can estimate that there was between 50 and 75,000 people in the church. So to have 1,100
perpetrators. Now, those 1,100, though, are throughout the history of the church.
True.
So but they are currently dead or alive.
But most of them happened after 1950.
Yes, because it's very, very hard to get information on what happened before. Sometimes we'll have an 80-year-old disclose some abuse and we'll learn about a much older perpetrator. But most of those are lost to history. They didn't have the permission to speak up. There was no benefit to it for them.
Right. I was going to say 1,100 regardless. It's a huge number. These are just the cases that you know about. So I'm sure it's bigger. I'm wondering also just in terms of abuse that people are talking about it, was it the same kind of abuse? And also, did any of them ever try to come forward? And what happened if they did?
So largely, it is all sexual abuse. It is a mix between children and adults. I would say most of them on the list are children.
Were children at the time.
Yes, were children at the time. Primarily, what we're talking about is sexual abuse.
Yeah.
Exclusively.
And I haven't gone through the list with a fine-tooth comb to determine this number, but well over 50% of those people did disclose to somebody in the church. And it was, in almost every instance, not reported to law enforcement, not taken seriously. The perpetrator, if he was a worker, was often just moved to another area.
If they even did anything at all.
Or just not moved at all. Sometimes they were just told, you got to forgive him and move on. So people didn't really have a choice, especially if they're a kid that's disclosing this to maybe a parent or to somebody else in the church. They didn't feel like they had the power to take it any further.
And that's one of the worst sides of exclusivity in a church like this is, if we kick this person out of the church, we are condemning them to hell, and we don't have the right to do that. So we have to figure out a way to make it go away, because we can't kick the perpetrator out of the church. If he repents, which if you'd repent, you'd go turn yourself in or you would do something. But they just imagine in their heads a scenario in which this person repented, and that's what they act on. A lot of times the survivor would be told, we just have to keep the unity. This will destroy the church, your meeting's unity. If you speak up about this, if you don't forgive this person, you might endanger his salvation and yours as well. So these are perfect tactics, whether they were intentional or not, which most of the time I think they weren't. They genuinely believed that this was for the better of the church and the people. And that's why a cover-up doesn't look like a cover-up much of the time, because people are genuinely doing what they think is going to be the best, but they've just been taught the wrong values.
Something regarding the numbers, an important statistic, at least the one that I think is important, is one that we came up with because we were able to compile enough data to pretty reliably what percentage of the United States male ministry were perpetrators. And based on the data that we pulled, which is going to be pretty conservative, most likely, based on the fact that we don't know all the things that are out there. But what we know is that 1 in 5 male ministers in the United States was a sexual perpetrator.
That we know of.
Just to give that a little bit of context. So that's 20%. And in the Catholic clergy, the number that we've been able to find is about 4% of the Catholic clergy are sexual abusers. So we're talking 5 times more prolific. It's just unbelievable.
It is unbelievable. And there's so much about what you just said about the response to it, that when people did come forward, that says something about, I think, why the numbers were so high. Because perpetrators wait and see how they're going to be responded to, but how other perpetrators are responded to. And if the victim needs to forgive the perpetrator, which happens way too often, that the victim is given this task to do something for the perpetrator on their behalf to protect them. So anyone who might be considering doing this is going to say, great, I get to do whatever I want. I'm going to deal with no consequences. And in fact, it's going to be incumbent upon my victim to do something for me in response. So yeah, it becomes sort of like a perpetrator's playground once they see that happening. It's very much like this case that was a couple of years ago on a college campus, which happens a lot. I mean, there's a whole rape culture, unfortunately, on college campuses. They're still very slow in responding to it. But I remember there was a judge who ruled in favor of this guy who had been in a frat and who had done a lot of things he shouldn't have done with females on campus. And he was let off because it would destroy his future if he had a record. Then the numbers of assaults went up on that campus. Of course they did. It's an incredible thing that the church, and a lot of churches, not just this one, that will tell people they have to forgive, are cultivating a greater problem in the way they respond or don't respond.
And they've really got the word forgiveness. They've really bastardized that word, in that it actually has nothing to do. What they're doing, instead of forgiving the person, what they're asking them to do is to enable the person. And that's an entirely different thing. And the other thing is that when communities find people who are hurting other people in that community, they reject the person from the community. But when you have a group that can't reject anybody, the statistics just grow and grow and grow and grow. Whereas typically communities are kind of like weed them out to a certain extent. But this just got worse and worse and worse because nobody would ever take care of them.
You can imagine the perpetrators that were up until 2023, almost every perpetrator of abuse within the church was looking at every single thing that was, because some of them would be known. You know, there was a few instances that they were known, but they see that they're not being taken seriously. So they're like, oh man, I'm good to go. I don't have anything to worry about. And I'm sure even now there's people that have done horrific things to other people. And they're just hopefully a little more nervous than they were before 2023, just sitting and waiting to see if their victim is going to come forward and expose them. For any abusers out there watching, it's just a matter of time.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's also incredible. I've talked to a number of people who were abused in different religious forms, and one of the things they're so angry about and they feel so betrayed by is that the person who abused them had been moved from another site. And so the group knew that they were just bringing like a viper into a church. And so people were going to get injured and bitten. And the people, the powers that be that are supposed to protect you, who are supposed to make you feel safe, know all along that they're putting you in danger. It is really quite incredible. So I want to thank you for all that you're doing and that you're going to be continuing to do. And it's an interesting thing to think about how you were thinking about staying for the sake of your children, which so many people do. It's like people staying also in marriages that are not good for the sake of the children so they don't have to be raised with divorce. And then when you were mentioning Abby homeschooling, I'm just thinking about what a beautiful job of homeschooling you're doing now. by setting the moral standard in your household, by doing this, by showing that this matters enough to do something that can be hard, that can be painful to look at, that can be difficult to keep hearing, but that it really is an important lesson. And it's parenting and leading by example, which is quite beautiful.
I appreciate that. We're not actually homeschooling anymore. Our kids will be the first to report something that doesn't look right or is harmful to somebody. Sometimes they feel like maybe I'm the only one that's noticing this or having this happen to me, because not every kid is mentioning it every time. But I'm like, hey, you're just kind of been a little bit saturated with speaking up. And here is why this is so important. And this is what consent looks like. And this is what it doesn't look like. And so I'm definitely proud of some of the things we've passed on to our children.
Yes, the unofficial homeschooling that continues throughout a lifetime. Okay, so tell us where people can find you and your work and the list. All that would be good for people to know about. Go for it.
Yeah, probably the primary public place that is helpful for people to check out is 2x2 Church Updates on Facebook. That's where we posted about various perpetrators and just other news and updates about things that are going on in the church.
That's good for people, especially maybe insiders who need to know things. I think outsiders, just curious, are probably going to find more on our TikTok channel.
True. Yeah. So we have a TikTok that we've talked about our personal stories on and also just various things about the church. Go into a lot of detail about every aspect of the church. And so it's on TikTok. It's at our2x2story.
Number two. So our number two X number two story.
Yeah. Something that might be helpful is on that 2x2 church updates page, there is a timeline document and we've tried to keep it up to date as much as possible. And it's just a short, relatively short. It's pretty long now, but it's all the major events that have happened in the church since March of 2023. And I think it's like 15 pages long or something
it's
like
long
that
now. Yeah. There's also the X2x2 support group, which people who have been in the truth and are no longer or are in the truth and want support in leaving, those people are welcome to join the X2x2 support group on Facebook. There are some join questions that you'll have to verify some things, and we might check in with you to vet people. Yeah, that's there too.
Okay. Wow, Abby and Mike, thank you so much for teaching us so much about the truth in air quotes and also about what can be done and how to help people not have to stay silent because they're worried about being the only voice. So to give other people a chance to have their voice be heard, and then people to jump onto that and feel empowered because they know they'll then have community in that, is really, really important. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much for this opportunity.
One more thing before you go. Thank you to Abby and to Mike. It's hard to know even where to start here. When you're dealing with numbers this big, when something is so systemic, when something is so woven in to the culture of a place, that it's hard to know if anyone knew it was either wrong or anyone felt like they could do anything. And you just feel totally unprotected because you were unprotected. The people who are supposed to be caring for people's souls, you want to know that they're safe people, but it really is such a crime on so many levels when they are not. And when they're given permission through the system itself to do this, and there's a cover-up, I hear so often, as I'm sure you've heard, where people find out that someone within their religious group is doing things they shouldn't. So instead of being brought up on charges, instead of being educated to not do it, they're just sent to somewhere else. And so then you have all these guilty parties. You have the people who sent them on to someone else and somewhere else so that they could be predators there. And then you have the people who hired them on or welcomed them in, knowing that they were dangerous people, knowing that they didn't care about not harming people who trusted them. One of the things that is so incredibly important when we talk about any of this, not only is to talk about it, which is really, really important. That's part of the reason that I started this podcast, so there'd be a platform for this sort of thing. But to be able to be clear about the language of what happened to you. I know that's something we covered a little bit when we were talking, but it is so vitally important to have a sense of understanding what happened to you so that you can say, I was abused, so you can say, I was neglected, so you can say, I went through child endangerment where I was really abandoned. I was put in the care of someone who I should never have been in a room with, especially alone. And so when people don't know that they've been abused, they don't know that something happened to them that was necessarily wrong, especially if it's given the exact opposite phraseology, like you're being specially chosen for this, or you should consider it to be an honor, or this is the way I show you love, or something else that feels equally sick. When they said that the writings that happened within this church were not clear, where you didn't really know what was being taught, what was being said, because it was done in parables and metaphors, it's reminding me of when there was this whole thing a couple years ago with QAnon, and Q was sending out these missives, these parables, these things that had to be decoded. People took them in like they were somehow the Dead Sea Scrolls, and they pored over them to see if they could decipher them like they're in some sort of other language. The thing with that is that it is very controlling, and it also is very evasive. You're not saying what's real, what's true. You're leaving it up to people to decipher. You're leaving it up to people to put the puzzle together. They might put together a puzzle that looks one way. Another group of people might look at it all and put together a puzzle that looks a totally different way. And so what is right and what is wrong? And if the answer to that is exactly, it's not enough. You want to have a grounding of information, meaning you want to know what it is and what it isn't. You want to know what you're taught. You want to know what a group stands for. You want to know how to get it right, if there's a way to get it right. But if you don't know what it is and how to define it, how do you know you're getting it right? I think it can leave people on edge a lot of the time. And I think it's a mean thing to do. If people came to my office and said, I am very unhappy in my relationship with my children, and I yell at them all the time, and they still don't listen to me. And I, as a therapist, I'm thinking, well, maybe stop yelling, and maybe we'll find other ways for you to talk to your kids. But instead, I start talking about, imagine a bird flying through the sky and is squawking loudly as opposed to chirping. What would that be like in the nest? What? I wouldn't do that to people. Don't leave it up to interpretation. Say what you mean. The thing is, though, if I really didn't know what I was doing, I could imagine speaking in parables and having people think, oh, she must be so wise because I have to decipher something. And then what it does is it would make my client dependent on me. So they'd have to say, well, this is what I think you meant. Is that what you meant? And if I really wanted to not be kind, wouldn't even come to mind, I would say, well, I don't know. What do you think I meant? And let's move it to a different metaphor. If we have fish in a lake, what? Stop. Let's just stop. I already have a hard time when I hear about people who have gone to see therapists and the therapist just says, Oh, that must be really hard. Yeah, I see. Not enough. Not enough information. I think it is absolutely disrespectful to not have a code that's clear, to not have teachings that are clear, but to also have so much about your organization that is shrouded in mystery and also shrouded in secrecy. What I love about what Abby and Mike were able to do was that they could say, okay, this is what I think really happened that was wrong. Let's see if we can put that out there and offer other people a chance to come forward and have a sense of sharing and getting what was right or what was wrong about this. It is so ultimately respectful. It is the way to make sure that people have a sense of what really happened and what happened to them, if it left them with some sort of impact like post-traumatic stress, well, there was a reason, because what happened to them was wrong. What happened to them was traumatizing to their system. What happened to them felt abandoning and endangering spiritually, psychologically, physically. And that deserves to be spoken about. It deserves to be shared. It deserves to have a forum. And it deserves to be treated clearly. Thank you so much to Abby and to Mike for going through what they're going through. It's hard to do that. It's hard sometimes when I put out content on the podcast with people who are unhappy with the things that I say, because they want the group that has harmed them, actually, to be seen in only a positive light, at least for now. Sometimes people who have attacked the content of what people are doing on this podcast, I'm sure also the site that Abby and Mike have, sometimes after a while will say, you know what? I said some horrible things because I wasn't open to the fact that all of this was happening. I didn't know yet, or I didn't know that what had happened to me was wrong because it was never talked about that way, or I wasn't ready to look at it yet, but now I am. So people who are responding to you in a negative way when you are just saying what's true are sometimes people who are not yet open to the idea that it happened to them, or that they have to really look at what they were involved in a way through cynical and critical eyes, because it means not only having loss, but engaging your anger and resentment, sometimes even beyond anger, engaging your rage. And I can imagine why people would want to delay that as long as possible. I get it. Thank you again to Abby and to Mike for all your work and for joining us today. Take care.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @IndoctrinationPodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.